Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You're going to think I'm being facetious, but I'm really not. Who is actually in charge of this economy right now, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 13th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do what we do on this program on Fridays. Take a minute to take stock, to look back and say, the heck happened? Kate Davidson is at the Wall Street Journal. Anna Swanson is with the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Kate, I want to get the politics of this out of the way, the transition mechanism. And I was only, as I said in the open, just kind of kidding. It kind of seems like nobody's in charge of this economy right now. President Trump has absented himself until a very brief press statement this afternoon. The Congress is doing Congress stuff and not passing bills. Who's in charge and does it matter if nobody is?
Who is at the wheel? That's a great question. And doesn't matter. I guess we'll find out. No, I think you're right. Although I would say, I think for many months now, the White House, the economic policymaking apparatus has been wanting, if you will. They've lost a number of people. They didn't really have like some of the heavyweights that you saw during the Obama administration in some of these top jobs, and that left a lot of the efforts to Congress. You know, a lot of the plans and proposals that we were seeing were legislation that either Nancy Pelosi or Mitch McConnell were putting together. So it's kind of more of the same on that front. The White House isn't really saying what they want to do. We heard a lot from the president before the election that he wanted a big stimulus package, but he's silent on that now, which has left a lot of people wondering, is he going to support something if Congress can manage to come together on a deal? Now, Mitch McConnell came out and said he does think there should be another aid package, but it should be small, which is what he said before. Nancy Pelosi wants to go big, so they're still pretty far apart, and they don't have someone to kind of push them to come together. Now, Joe Biden spoke with Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Maybe he'll play a bigger role in the talks. I think that that's an important question, but right now, we really don't know.
Anna, what do you think of this idea that as the president recedes from the limelight, probably against his will, President-elect Biden is stepping up and sort of has already begun talking about a stimulus bill, as Kate was saying, with Schumer and Pelosi?
Well, I think, you know, to a certain extent, that's necessary and proper. I mean, I don't think President Trump needs to necessarily abdicate his economic policy role if he wants to step up and, help people that are suffering right now. That would be great. I think, a bit of that transition is natural. I mean, the question is, you know, to what extent can President-elect Biden actually play, a significant informal role until he really gets into office. And his team is barred from doing certain things until they officially assume power, right? So, technically that should really full steam ahead in January.
So what's interesting is neither of you said, Kai, it's Jay Powell who's running this economy. Of course. I thought that was going to be the answer because I had this piece of tape all queued up. The chairman of the Fed he was part of a conference yesterday with European central bankers and folks over there, a virtual conference, of course. And he said something that just struck me right between the eyes. And I want to play this first piece of tape. Drew, hit that tape.
We're not going back to the same economy. We're recovering, but to a different economy.
That, Kate Davidson, is kind of, it just hit me that, wow, it's going to totally be different.
Yeah, I think that a lot of Fed officials have been warning in recent weeks and months about this uneven recovery that we're starting to see. It's becoming more clear. Some people call it a K-shaped recovery where, there are certain people who are maybe they work in offices or administrative positions. They are, what you might call white collar workers are doing better. They're seeing improvements, and the people at the bottom are not. people who are in service industries, restaurants, bars, you know, hotels, hospitality, those service industries, they tend to be low-income workers. They tend to be women and minorities, and they have been most affected, and it looks like they may have a tougher time coming back. I mean, if you just think about your own behaviors mm-hmm. and the changes that you're going to be making, even next year, if there is a vaccine, you know, how long will it be before we're regularly going to the movies again and eating indoors and flying on airplanes? And that's part of it. But I think also this accelerated, the pandemic has accelerated existing trends. Greater use of technology yeah. and telework and automation, and that stuff also just tends to disproportionately fall on and hurt burden workers yeah. sort of on the bottom rungs of the labor force.
On a little change of gears here, I want to talk to you about a piece you wrote based on some news earlier this week that the president had barred American investment in Chinese firms with military ties over there. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk not specifically about that piece, but about what you think that says about the next 2 months of the U.S.-China relationship, which is, of course, mm-hmm. the relationship of the two biggest economies in the world. And it's clear that the president continues to believe it is in his advantage and the country's advantage to press the Chinese.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So I think this was an interesting signal that the president's kind of offensive against China when it comes to trade and technology and all these different dimensions isn't stopping in the final months. You know, they're not easing up on these economic hostilities. And in fact, I do hear that, you know, there are some other measures floating around that they're considering mm-hmm. on China, whether it comes to, you know, measures related to Hong Kong or Xinjiang. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens. You know, a lot of these are executive actions. So if he wanted to, a president-elect Biden could reverse them. But it's unclear how many of them he's actually going to want to reverse. You know, we know that the Biden team sees a lot of Trump measures on China in general as kind of clumsy and unstrategic. But would Biden pay a political price for reversing some of these? You know, no one in Washington wants to be painted as weak on China. And unless the Biden team can get some significant concessions from China for reversing some of these measures, right. They may not see very much upside to that.
Kate, super quick. I can't let you go without talking about Judy Shelton, President Trump's nominee to the Federal Reserve. She is going to get a vote next week in the lame duck session of Congress. Not uncontroversial, this woman. Give us the 30 seconds on why she's not controversial and what that might mean for politicizing the Federal Reserve.
That's right. So in modern times or in recent years, these nominations have become much more partisan. They tend to get voted on sort of on a party line vote. And that's what we can expect to see with Judy Shelton. Republicans, because they back the president still, are likely to support her, even though privately some of them have expressed concerns about her views. I think ultimately, though, it's important to remember that the Fed, the Federal Open Market Committee that sets interest rates, it's a committee and it's run by the chairman. She will just be one member. And the other point is that she'll be filling a term that actually ends in early 2024. Mm. So it's quite short. I think that's giving some comfort to Democrats who are worried about her and her views.
Kate Davidson at the Wall Street Journal, Anna Swanson at the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street on this mid-November Friday in month 9 of this pandemic. What? Me worry? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you happen to be listening to us right now while driving on a road or walking on a sidewalk, there is a real good chance that that road or sidewalk was paid for with debt issued on the municipal bond market. Munis fund the construction of sewage systems and school systems and power grids. And look, I get it. Muni bonds are not the sexiest thing in the world by quite a ways. But right now, in this pandemic economy, oh, they're having a moment. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
The municipal bond market is the financial backbone of three-quarters of the country's infrastructure, says Abby Ertz, who follows municipal credit at FHN Financial. It funds big projects, roads, tunnels, and bridges, but also, she says,
it funds things like college dorms and nursing homes, also public transit systems.
The vast majority of municipal bonds also have a unique feature. the interest they pay is exempt from taxes. That's appealing to wealthy individual investors who buy the majority of muni bonds and who've been saving more money during the pandemic, says Guy Labat, chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
They're also higher end taxpayers, and so they have more to benefit on average from the tax exemption.
That's not the only reason municipal bonds are in demand. They're slightly riskier investments than treasury bonds or corporate bonds. Winifred Caesar, head of credit strategy at Wells Fargo, says that means
the municipal bond market continues to trade at a yield that's pretty attractive.
In other words, muni bonds pay higher interest. Caesar says the strong demand for them right now is a good sign for the economy.
Historically, when investors start to feel confident about seeing broader economic recovery, then they're more willing to push their cash into riskier parts of the market.
One index of demand for the riskiest municipal bonds has almost climbed back to its pre-pandemic level. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Three words to start your business day on Monday. The Marketplace Morning Report. David Brancaccio and the gang tell you all you need to know. The thing about bond market stories is that bonds can be a little bit ephemeral, right? I mean, yes, they can be bought and sold, and sure, it's a multi-trillion dollar market, but they're just pieces of paper. So let's talk about something a little more tangible, shall we? How about steel? We've gotten our go-to steel person on the phone. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, it is so good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you, Kai.
Let me get the contextual ground truth question out of the way first. How is business?
Thank you for asking. It's really improving. Going into COVID, things were pretty bad, more than just the doldrums. It was really a struggle and has consistently picked up over the last 6 months.
And then short to medium term future, how are you feeling?
Short, really good.
Yeah.
And my crystal ball gets super cloudy. It might have a couple cracks once I get through the spring for all kinds of reasons. The transition of government, COVID, the economy, we are running at a pretty aggressive clip right now. So the market can't, you know, continue at this pace.
Well, tell me about the clip that is running for you. I mean, you're just seeing more orders because people are buying cars and dishwashers and refrigerators?
Yeah, cars, dishwashers, refrigerators, light trucks. Everyone's home more. Dishwashers were not meant to be run twice a day. And today I'm replacing two faucets in my house. You know, everything's getting fixed.
That's a really good point. I hadn't actually considered the whole dishwasher thing, but we're definitely running it at my house too. But is this pandemic, or has it not affected your supply chain at all? I mean, can you get the materials that you need?
Yeah, so I'm kind of in the middle. I'm more that traditional middleman.
Yeah.
So supply is definitely short. It's short for two reasons. One reason it's short is we have major tariffs, so there's no or very, very little import. And the steel mills are acting fairly controlled on their output. They can't really staff full shifts because of COVID.
Yeah.
So output is greatly challenged, which is, in my world, a mixed blessing.
Mm-hmm.
Why? My inventory is worth way more.
Right.
So I'm selling inventory that's been sitting, which is exciting. I get to make some profit, which I haven't been able to do very well in the last year and a half, but it cannot be replaced. It could be replaced to some degree, but at really high numbers,
right,
which is why I go back to where I started. When is it going to go over the cliff? Because when I've been here every other time and I panic that I'm going to run out, I buy more, pay too much, and then wait 2 years till I can sell it.
Right. So let's talk about the guy whose job it is now to, in theory, prevent it from going over the cliff. You are on the record on this program repeatedly as not having been a fan of President Trump's. You like some of his policies. You don't like the way they are executed. As we sit here looking at the likelihood of divided government with President Biden in the White House in 2 months, how you feeling?
Well, I'm certainly feeling a lot better than when we were talking in 2016, for a lot of reasons, not only because my guy won, okay, I don't have to gloat, but also because when you and I spoke, if you recall, and if our listeners recall at that time, I had people in the office crying.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm a lot happier that my guy makes people feel less afraid of their person, of their gender orientation, their sexuality, their religion, the color of their skin. As far as policy, I don't know. I kind of like the divided government for a while, mm-hmm. Kai. I think mm-hmm. that I'm so afraid of the far left. And I think that in Joe Biden, you have this compromiser. So what if we actually have a centralist experience?
Lisa Goldenberg, she is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
You too, Kai. Take care. It's wonderful to catch up.
Coming up.
TV, in a lot of ways, is like the steroids version of yard signs.
Yeah, we've all seen those ads, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 399 today, 1.3%, 29,479. The NASDAQ gained 119 points, 1%, 11,829. The S&P 500 picked up 48 points, about 1.3%. 35 and 85 there. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added a little bit better than 4%. The NASDAQ down a little bit more than 0.5%. S&P 500 up 2.1%. If you're planning to head out on the highway looking for adventure this weekend, I could write a song, huh? A gallon of regular gas is going to cost you $2.13 on average. That's according to AAA. Trending upward, but still about 5 cents cheaper than a month ago. Nearly half a buck below where it was a year ago. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We are expecting, to what should be nobody's surprise, record online sales this holiday season, maybe 30% or more above last year's numbers. That's one estimate that's out there. And numbers like that, well, they are stressing retailers out who never expected to have to handle that many packages at their fulfillment centers. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports on what some of those companies are doing to adapt.
This holiday season, Walmart is converting 42 warehouses that normally ship products to its stores so they can also fulfill online orders, which is more complicated than it might sound. If you're shipping products to stores, you tend to move stuff around in large units, pallets filled with cases of diapers or video games or whatever. Mark Lang teaches marketing at the University of Tampa.
Those distribution centers are built for that physically, in terms of racking and forklifts and trucks inside and carts.
But at a warehouse that fulfills online orders,
now pickers, they're pulling individual units off.
Workers take whatever you ordered, a package of diapers, a couple of bars of soap, put it all in a box and load it onto a truck so it can eventually be delivered to you. To do this, Walmart had to update its computer systems and set aside whole sections of its warehouses. This is something Walmart can do because it has a lot of warehouses. Brian Eshelman at Alex Partners says smaller retailers are taking a different approach, one they piloted this spring when the pandemic hit, using their stores to ship online orders.
They literally put inventory in the aisles that would normally be reserved for customers, to set up almost like a mini distribution center in the store.
Meanwhile, Pepsi, which sells a lot of packaged foods around the holidays, just opened a small, fully automated warehouse outside Chicago, which it says can process orders 7.5 times faster. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You're not really supposed to gather in big groups outside your family right now. Big sporting events and concerts and theater and movies are all no-nos. So what can you do? How about kayaking? The outdoor recreation economy, everything from biking and hunting to gardening and snow activities, that's the official designation, it made up 2.1% of gross domestic product last year. The entire economy, 2.1% of it. That's more than mining, about the same, sadly, as broadcast and telecommunications. It has been growing every year, the outdoor economy has, since the government started measuring it 3 years ago. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, some parts of it are doing real well. Others, not so much.
Dale Davis has never seen as many people riding bicycles in Farmington, New Mexico as he has during the pandemic.
I've never seen so many people out on the trails. I've never seen so many people riding down the streets.
A lot of them are riding bikes they bought at his shop, 505 Cycles. Ever since COVID hit, he says, sales have been through the roof.
We're up exponentially.
A lot of businesses that sell outdoor gear, bikes, kayaks, paddle boards, hiking gear, have been doing well during the pandemic, says Lisa Ongenbrug of the Outdoor Industry Association.
The demand for getting outside, whether it is in a neighborhood park or a national park, has been huge. It's one of the few things you can do socially distance.
But that has not helped all parts of the outdoor economy. Businesses that rely on bringing groups of people together have been struggling, says Axie Navas, director of the New Mexico Outdoor Recreation Division.
So fly fishing outfitters, hunting outfitters, working as they are in a segment of the outdoor industry that is hospitality focused, it's been really hard for them.
90% of outdoor recreation businesses in the state, she says, have lost money because of COVID. But around the country, Lisa Ongenbrug of the Outdoor Industry Association says,
because more people are getting outside, I think they're recognizing the health and wellness benefits, particularly for your mental health.
And long term, she expects that will end up bringing more business to the outdoor economy. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
They're still counting or recounting the last of the ballots for this election cycle. But with all the money that's been spent, $14 billion from the top of the ticket on down, political operatives are digging through the wins and the losses and the data, hoping to find some lessons for the next big political fight, those Senate races in Georgia in January. Here's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams.
It's pretty early to make sweeping generalizations about this year's election, but in terms of how campaigns spend money, there are already some takeaways. Lucy Caldwell is a political strategist and technologist.
2020 was the year where we can all agree that there is not a silver bullet and that the jig is up on some of the tools that people got so dependent upon in cycles past.
Like deluging voters with emails and fundraising texts and saturating the airwaves with TV ads.
It's straight up corruption. Fighting corruption is my job.
Some people want to play political games with this. I just think it's the right thing to do.
I'm asking for your vote to save our country.
Because it's time we had a senator who put Georgians first, like me.
TV, in a lot of ways, is like the steroids version of yard signs. It makes donors and the candidates, let's be honest, themselves feel happy about what they're doing, but it's not a particularly effective way to spend money.
While ads do raise awareness of a candidate, those who study political races say beyond a certain point, viewers just tune them out. That may especially be true when ads for a congressional or Senate race come from or are funded by people outside the state.
We can use this as a reasonable inference from what we saw that voters may not like the quote unquote nationalization of these congressional races.
Michael Franz is co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracked political ads in the campaign. That lesson is going to be key in ad strategies for the Georgia runoffs.
And so if Democrats are going to try to fundraise and put ads on TV using that pitch, saying help us win back the Senate, it may not work if Georgian voters think that the local concerns don't matter as much as these national concerns.
And many political activists complain those ads often come at the expense of strategies that are more effective.
Campaigns that spend millions and millions on TV and digital ads and don't have organizers in urban, rural, and suburban areas, that needs to be retired.
Amy Allison is president of She the People, a group that works to get progressive women of color into office.
Campaign teams that don't reflect the diversity of the Democratic Party, that should be retired at every level. Campaign teams and volunteers should be as diverse as the communities they represent.
Allison says the Democrats need to look to diverse coalitions like the one Stacey Abrams built in Georgia and let them take the lead. As for Republicans?
Well, I hope we learn that we really need to get better at voting by mail and the early vote.
Chris Jankowski is a Republican political consultant.
It's like spotting your opponent a 2-touchdown lead in a football game with confidence that somehow you're going to make it all up on election day.
And he says in Georgia, in January, when control of the Senate is on the line, that's not a mistake Republicans will make again. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, labor news from baseball. The Miami Marlins announced their new general manager today. Kim Ng is her name, the first woman to run a baseball team, also the first Asian American. She did stints with the White Sox, the Yankees, and the Dodgers. Derek Jeter, the CEO of the Marlins, also, and not for nothing, a former Yankee great, made the hire. Ng said in a statement, quote, "I entered Major League Baseball as an intern, and after decades of determination, it is the honor of my career to lead the Miami Marlins as their next general manager." Also, go Yankees. That last bit was me, not her. Okay, we got to go. No moment of economic context today. You're going to have to find your own because I went a minute and a half long in the rap. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassid is the managing director of news. I don't know why it's a quiz. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.